Right, okay, we have Sedra Baha Lotecha. So in these stormy times, let's see what the Torah is telling us, and let's see what we can learn from the weekly Torah reading. This Baha Lotecha is going to be read this week in the synagogues, not everywhere in the world, because in Israel, they are one Sedra ahead. So for a few weeks, there's going to be a dissonance between the Galut, the diaspora, and Israel, because when we go back to Pesach, the last day of Pesach in England and the diaspora in general was on Shabbat. So therefore, on Shabbat, they did not read the Sedra of the week. They read a reading appropriate for Pesach.
For Pesach, oh, I see.
But in Israel, that day was already the first day after Pesach. So they read the Sedra of the week.
Why
so
did they continue to have the extra day? I can understand, historically, they didn't know, weren't quite sure which day, so they... But that doesn't exist today. It doesn't make any logical sense to continue to have this difference.
You know, it's very interesting. Well, you're talking about the difference of having 2 days festival outside Israel. There are many things in Judaism which began as some kind of exigency in a problematic situation and then were approved as being a very good idea. One of these is the synagogue. Synagogues didn't really exist before the destruction of the first temple. There was the temple in Jerusalem. People would go to the temple in Jerusalem. They might pray in an individual way daily, but they didn't have a synagogue concept. When they were sent into exile into Babylon, they felt bereft. They felt so completely remote. The temple was in ruins. They're far from God. It's destruction. Ezekiel invented the synagogue. He called it the Mikdash Ma'at, the little temple, the little sanctuary. And so they created the synagogue. And then when they came back to Israel and rebuilt the second temple, they then continued to have synagogues. And the Talmud tells us that at the time of the destruction, hundreds of years later, 400 years later, approximately, of the second temple, There were lots and lots of synagogues everywhere and all over the country. There were synagogues. So the second day of the festival, people liked the idea. I mean, I think it's a terrible strain. You work very, very hard to get organized for Pesach. Then comes the first Seder night. You're really quite exhausted. And then you have the day in which you can relax. Then you have the second Seder night. You know, that's a very real night. Then you can really put yourself into it. But in Israel, it's gone. Boom. So outside Israel, the sages, you know, over the generations have strongly approved the maintaining of the custom of the second day of the festival. But anyway, as a result of that, there is a certain out-of-sync quality between the Sedra. So the Sedra here and in the whole of the diaspora is Baal Otecha, but in Israel it's already Shalach Lecha, it's the next Sedra. However, we've got Baal Otecha, and let's see what we can gain from
that. How do they come together?
They come together by some kind of juggling with, you know, at one point someone has two Sedras together and like they join like Matot and Masei. I think that's it.
This is Yoni's Parsha.
Ah, Baalotecha.
No,
Matot. Oh, wow. Well, Matot and Masei.
He was incredible. I mean, we thought he was going to end up as an actor.
All right, I don't know, but somehow they come together. I'm not quite sure. Well, one would have to look at a luach for England and a luach for Israel at the same time. So they come together. Now, so, Millie, would you like to begin? Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe.
There are two, at the top?
No, the middle one. Where it says verse 1.
Sorry, I'm missing the
book. Now, with you, do you want the Hebrew text?
I'll just
Right.
Yeah, okay.
You've got the English.
וידבר השם אל משה לאמור, דבר אל אהרון ואמרת אליו, בעלותך את הגרות אל מול
פני... נרות.
This is very bad. I can't see. No, it's my eyes. And this silly light.
One second.
Well, I've only got one
page of Hebrew. No, I haven't given you the Hebrew. If you want the Hebrew, I'll give it to you.
No, that's all right. Okay,
so where were you reading from?
From here.
Here.
Lovely, thank you. וידבר השם אל משה לאמור, דבר אל אהרון ואמרת אליו, בעלותך את הנרות אל מול פני המנורה, יאירו שבעת הנרות, ויעש כן אהרון אל מול פני המנורה, העלה נרותיה כאשר ציווה השם את משה. וזה מעשה המנורה, מקשה זהב עד ירחה, עד פרחה, מקשה הוא כמראה, אשר הראה השם את משה, כן עשה את המנורה.
נכון, beautiful. Okay, do you want to translate?
Oh, this is
here, small. Here, take it from the other one, it's bigger.
Just read it here in parts, but...
Yeah.
God spoke to Moses, telling him to speak to Aaron and to say to him, when you light the lamps, the seventh lamps shall illuminate the menorah. Aaron did that, lighting the lamp, to illuminate the menorah, as God commanded Moses. The menorah was made of a single piece of beaten gold. Everything from the base to its blossom consisted of a single piece of beaten metal. The menorah was thus made exactly according to the vision that God showed Moses.
Right. So here we have this little chunk about the menorah. That's now this. There are a number of points about it. First of all, it said when you light the lamps. Now, if you notice, there's an asterisk at the word light, and the footnote says literally raise up, baha'alotecha, when you raise up the lights.
Raise, yes. So you're supposed to put it on an elevated position, is that what?
Well, the menorah already is in an elevated position, but what Rashi says is that when you're kindling the light, whatever you're lighting it with, you know, let's imagine some kind of taper, you should hold the flame next to the wick and until the wick itself starts burning upwards. So you have to madlik ad shetehei shal hevet ola me'eleh.
Well, how can you light it any other way?
You're quite right. That's the only way you can light anything. Yeah.
Because when I watch my daughter and wife light the candles, of course they hold it. They hold it longer than.
Yeah. Otherwise, nothing is lit. But it's an interesting idea that what's happening when you're lighting something is that you're transferring the fire so that the thing that you're lighting now has the fire itself. Mm. Now, all this relates to the way in which the menorah is interpreted, not just as a beautiful structure in order to give illumination with seven lights and some kind of symbol of holiness or of the Jewish peoples, a symbol of holiness for the Jewish people, but it's a symbol of the Jewish people. The menorah is a symbol of the Jewish people. Now the key to that, or one of the keys, is what Millie read, the menorah was made of a single piece of beaten gold. Now this is very hard to conceive. Rashi makes the point quite clearly that it means it was not made of separate pieces soldered together, but, which is the normal way you would imagine making a menorah, a seven-branch candlestick. You would think you'd take separate branches and somehow fix them together. Rashi uses the idea of soldering. But Rashi says it should be made of one block of gold, somehow fashioned into the seven branches and the base. That's from the one block of gold. Now, how exactly this was done, I don't know. And indeed, it says that making the menorah was a challenging thing, and it speaks about the vision that God showed Moses. So the way in which the menorah should be made was actually something visionary.
But was it not cast?
Now, if it's cast, then that would be easy, right? The lost wax method would be a wonderful way of making a menorah all in one go from molten gold.
Yes.
Well, you see the word miksha.
Beaten.
Yes, that's right.
I did get that.
Yeah, you see.
So then the only way I related to it was, it was one sheet of gold. And you beat it to shape the... You cut it first.
Uh-huh. I used to make
jewelry.
Cut it
with a scissors as such.
Right.
And then you beat it until it makes them an ornament.
So you start off with like a flat sheet.
A flat sheet.
So that might be, you know, that might
no,
be...
No, you couldn't, because you need to have the depth to put the nerot on. You can't...
Yeah, but you could fold over.
It. You can fold it.
Yeah, you can beat...
So you mean it with a thin little thing?
Yeah.
No, it's not so thin.
But
you
it's a
you
sheet.
Then, you, but you start with a sheet, and then you fold over with each arm, having cut out the arm,
yes.
So to speak. You fold them over to make them more substantial. Look, that might be a way of doing it.
Well, I did metalwork at school.
you did metal at
well,
school.
I actually
made jewelry, gold jewelry and silver jewelry.
Sure.
This was the one of the
did
four
you do anything
years.
In solid gold?
So no, and it is possible, but it's really we are talking about a big thing. It's not.
It's big. Yeah, it's big. It's quite.
It's
quite.
It's quite heavy. It's big.
Well, it's big, but it doesn't say how thick it is. I mean, you know, you could have a tall.
And it would stand on something.
You then have the question whether there could be some. You know, you could fold over. It's an interesting idea. The point is that there's a Rashi which says. Cain asa et ha-menorah. Who made the menorah?
Yeah.
And so Rashi says there's one opinion, God made the menorah, because no one else could work out how to make it. So should they make it out of sheet gold? Should
yeah.
they do it this way? But it says mixture, should it be molten?
It's very interesting, the point that you said, that a Jew, it represents... both at the president's home there is a menorah, and in the Israeli Knesset there is a menorah,
mm-hmm.
and when the Knesset was in a tiny little place at the center of town with a little courtyard, there was a massive menorah. One of the first things that they erected there was
shop was on the corner.
Shop for
my what? Hair salon.
Oh, you had a hair salon.
Well, there was so much. Was where. Yeah. With the Knesset HaYeshan. So that little park, my hair salon was in front of me.
So,
but there's a statue of a horse now.
What, you mean there's no menorah anymore?
No, not in that section. They moved it
to
the
No, they moved it to the new
Knesset,
of
and
course.
And they put
a
funny-shaped horse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was a symbol that... kind of with the election of Israel, it immediately was taken up by non-religious people, basically, which I find incredible.
Well, I mean, Hanukkah is, in when we light the menorah, in Israel, is a national festival. It's not only religious people who keep Hanukkah.
It's true.
It's a very... You know, and it represents the Jews fighting against the ancient Greeks. It's got many images.
I think also at the time Harav Kook was the chief rabbi of the Jewish community there. So, and I think he was very open on both sides. I mean, he was literally with the non-religious and the
absolutely.
Religious.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let's just explore this further. So if we see this idea that the menorah is made of one lump, of gold. It's solid. Whether it's a sheet gold which is cut and then curved over, or but it's one piece of gold together. It's not different bits that are separate. Now that helps the Hasidic explanation of the menorah, that the menorah represents the unity and the essence of the Jewish people, and it also represents the diversity of the Jewish people, because the seven lamps of the menorah are seen as different kinds of flame. There's one flame, Rabbi Schneur Zalman says, of flame of love like burning fire. There's another flame which is like love which flows like water. Two kinds of love. One kind of love which burns, and another kind of love which flows. And then you might have each of the seven branches is a different kind of emotional quality, a different kind of spiritual quality. Now you can imagine the Jewish people being composed of diverse people who have different qualities. This one is the flaming love, this one is the love like flowing water, another one is some other kind of emotion, and so on, and yet they're all part of one menorah.
So how come we have the Jacob affair?
The which affair?
The Jacob affair. Louis Jacob, I mean, he was...
Well, that's why that was so shocking, right? That's why that was such a distressing event. You know, and whenever there is any kind of separation within the Jewish community for some reason or other, these are very distressing events. You're quite right. Now, the other point about the menorah is this thing of lighting the menorah. Because we have an interactive relationship with each other as the Jewish people. We have a role where each of us can help the other person's flame to be lit. So lighting the menorah is something that in fact we can all take part in. And so that sense of lighting the menorah, that we all as people, we try to inspire each other. And that inspiration is something which has to be until the flame burns up with its own strength. So in other words, you impart to the other person, they should become a source of inspiration as well. So the whole thing of the interactive relationship among the Jewish people of sharing light, sharing the flame. So that's an aspect that we get from this concept of the menorah. Now, do you want to look on your tablet for Titus Arch menorah?
Yeah, I've seen
that earlier. I went to Rome.
Oh, yes?
And, I said, because we're not supposed to walk under it, but you can't anyway, because they put the chain with it.
Right.
Obviously, to preserve it. I mean, that's the Israeli national symbol for that particular
image of the menorah.
Image, yeah, from the Titus Arch.
Yeah, yeah, that's the one that is in the Knesset.
The actual one, yes.
Yeah.
I thought that the Knesset had a slightly different styling. The one outside the Knesset. The one outside the Knesset is somehow more angular, I thought.
This one?
But the national seal, on the Israeli national seal.
Yes. Now, can we see? What I'm trying to see is the dragon, which is on the base.
A dragon on the base?
Yes.
I forgot about that, yeah.
Doesn't that hail from the Roman tradition?
Well, the artist who made the... let's see.
That's interesting.
Yeah, but this is not the original. This is the second temple. Yes, so this is the second temple, and
Rome.
Exactly.
So that's.
Let me see if I can get to.
It's not the original first one.
So now you see the interesting thing is that Maimonides. Now you may have this picture in the pack that I gave you of the bat. Last page.
It's not in the Hebrew.
Oh, it's in the
English. No, it's in the English. Here, let me give you another one.
Yes, I see, yes.
Now, the right-hand picture is a very interesting picture because it occurs in a manuscript which is in the Bodleian Library in Oxford. And this is a manuscript of a book by Maimonides. And the book is his commentary on the Mishnah. And in the part of the Mishnah here, the part of the Mishnah which speaks of the menorah, he includes
the picture on the emblem of Israel, the inscriptions on the base of the menorah.
Oh, well.
That's not the actual there, but that's...
Right. Oh, that's funny. Yeah, thank you. So this diagram is in this book written by Maimonides.
This diagram?
Yeah, in his own handwriting.
Oh.
And it's very interesting because he corrects it. Maimonides, he wrote it out, and then later on he corrected it and, he added bits or crossed things out, changed things. So, and you can see
his own
copy. And in that copy is this diagram. Mm-hmm. Now, the diagram, we can see ourselves, is carefully drawn. You can look at the segment of a circle at the bottom. It's like very, very carefully drawn circle. It must have been done with a compass or something like that. And then you've got the line of the...
That's the actual photograph on the...
Right.
That is the actual Titus arch.
Right.
But you still can't see the dragon.
I can't see the dragon. Can't see the dragon. Because the existence of the dragon is like one of the things indicating that it's a Roman creation, not necessarily directly relating, you know. Put on it a candelabrum with seven branches, you know. So the artist, like in many Jewish books from the 16th century, things printed in the 16th century had like, mermaids the decorating the text, you know, with bare breasts, you know, like as part of the Talmudic page. So it's just what the non-Jewish artist decided. Well, this will be a good thing to put it.
What was the reason?
January 1994, the Baltimore Sun did an article on Israel's official menorah held to be pagan in origin.
What is the reason for the seven kanim, seven branches?
Well, the simple understanding of that is that it relates to the seventh sfirot. The seventh sfirot, seven divine emanations. And that in fact relates to the idea of the menorah as a structure which, now it says... This is wonderful. Well done.
What is it talking about, seven?
That's why I think 7 days.
Yes, look at that.
It should always light, no?
The mystical number.
Look at that. That.
Ouch.
Is that from the actual Arch of Titus?
Well, that's not a photograph, but that is what is on the Arch of Titus.
Right. Good heavens.
Ugh. Yeah, well, that's, yes.
Yeah, creepy crawlers.
Yeah.
What?
So this is a statement saying that it's from the Roman, yeah?
Yeah.
That means it's Roman.
Underlining its Roman origin.
Yeah. Goodness me.
Well, that was Roman.
Shocking.
Yes.
I forgot.
Amazing. Sure. Thanks very much.
So this is the one that was in the temple.
Well, this is the one that is on the Arch of Titus. And so that's why.
Yeah.
The Lubavitcher Rebbe says, why take the image from the Arch of Titus as your image of the menorah? Take the one from Maimonides' book.
Which is this one?
This one.
Right. Now I understand why you brought it.
And you see, he's drawn the straight lines of the seven branches, and then now the menorah was decorated with cups, it says, kind of goblets, and these woodcut, it looks like a kind of woodcut or potato cut.
Yes.
That's where you stamp, you carve the wood, dip it in ink, and then stamp it. So that seems to be how he's made this image here. And then there is the interesting question of which way the cups are pointing. And it looks as if these are narrow, they're upside down cups. And the idea of them being upside down cups is because the radiance comes from the top where the flames are, and it flows down through the menorah into the world.
Oh, how lovely. Yes.
That image of the menorah as something with a flow of radiance coming down into the universe, into the world. And so that's the spiritual energy of
the
menorah.
You once explained that the light flows from us to the rest of the world.
Yes.
You gave that from us the light.
Well, that's the whole Rosh Hashanah image, that on Rosh Hashanah, life force, new life force, comes to Israel and the Jewish people, and from Israel
from
and the Jewish people,
the
flows to the whole world. Mm. Yes.
It's a beautiful concept.
Yeah.
And just like this, the concept of it flowing like down towards...
Also to Israel's enemies?
To everybody.
Well, that's the thing, you see, deep down...
to everybody.
They're not Israel's enemies.
Exactly.
Deep down, it's... And you know, Yeshuat Hashem Keheref Ayin, you know, in a moment, people could change their whole attitude. Like you see this, these people saying, you know, Israel's a good thing. That could happen. I remember a very interesting interview with or talk by a lady from Gaza. She was brought up in Gaza. And she said there was no talk whatsoever of peace with Israel. Everything was about war, destruction, and now she somehow thinks about the world in a completely different way. But that change of mindset could be in a second. So there are many things which are concealed.
No, I understand.
But everything deep down has divine life force.
I know, and I understand.
And if it's spiritual enough, there is no enemies.
Then when you think of the Holocaust, then everything kind of falls apart. I mean, it's like, where did this come from?
Well, it's true.
Where the Jews, and there was a trial in Auschwitz, wasn't there? There was a play on the BBC where
putting
rabbis,
God on trial.
Yes, they put God on trial.
Mm.
And found God guilty.
Yeah, I found it fascinating.
And then they said Minister or
that's
afterwards.
Right. Yeah.
Prayed.
Do you understand?
Again.
Now it's time. Right, we found God guilty. Now it's time to pray the afternoon prayer.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is...
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
The breach of covenant.
Well, it's fully in line with the Talmudic tradition. We have a very remarkable relationship with God.
There's a show up there, I think it was about a three-hour play, you see, too.
My name is Abdul.
But I don't remember anything
country,
of the play except that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's all I remember.
Yeah, it was somewhere. I mean, it was almost a huge topic, a real challenge for a playwright.
But very special. Right. Okay, so that is one element of the Seder of the week, Bahalotecha. So now, are you a Levite?
No.
Anyone here a Levite? No. Now we have another concept, Passover in the desert. Would you like to read that? God spoke to Moses. So it's on page 407.
So was he listening to you? And God spoke to Moses saying.
No. It says in the middle of the page, Passover in the desert, God spoke to Moses in the Sinai desert.
In the Sinai desert in the second year of the Exodus from Egypt. The first month, saying, the Israelites shall prepare the Passover offering as its proper time. The proper time for its preparation shall be the 14th day of the month.
Of this month,
in the afternoon. They must prepare it in accordance with all its decrees and laws.
Yeah, you see, when the Jews were in Egypt, the last day, basically, they had to slaughter the Paschal lamb, gather into groups which would eat the lamb together in the evening, roasting it.
Families.
That's right. And then at midnight came the death of the firstborn, and then they went free from Egypt the next morning. So there is, it's stated then that this would be an annual festival.
And so next year we have lamb for Pesach.
We don't have meat in this house. Sorry, it's not going to change.
Oh dear. Oh,
look, and your children, Mashiach is going to come.
Millie, Mashiach will come and we will all have lamb for the Seder. Including the vegans.
Amen.
And now, so every year they would take a lamb and slaughter it at the temple and then eat the lamb. It had to be slaughtered at the temple and the blood was sprinkled on the altar, but then the actual lamb was roasted and ate in a family group in Jerusalem. It had to be eaten in Jerusalem. So people would come to Jerusalem in order to do that. Now, before they had Jerusalem and the temple was built in Jerusalem, the center was wherever the sanctuary was, the Mishkan. Yes. And the Mishkan is here at this moment, it's in the desert. So they came out of Egypt, they came to Mount Sinai, they got the Ten Commandments. There was a whole kerfuffle with the golden calf, but after that, they built the Mishkan, and now we have the celebration of this Passover festival. So Moses, do you want to go on? Moses spoke
to the Israelites, telling them to prepare the Passover offering. They prepared the Passover offering in the Sinai desert on the 14th of the first
month.
In the afternoon, the Israelites did exactly as God had instructed Moses.
Right, so that was a beautiful celebration. They made the Passover, they had the Passover lamb, they slaughtered it, they sprinkled the blood on the altar, they roasted it, they ate it in family groups. It was a wonderful, joyful thing. But there were, however, you got that from verse 6?
Some men, yes. who had come in contact with the dead and were therefore ritually unclean so that they could not prepare the Passover offering on that day. During the course of that day, they approached Moses and Aaron, quote unquote, "We are ritually unclean as a result of contact with the dead," the men said to Moses. "But why should we lose out and not be able to present God's offering at the right time along with the other Israelites?" "Wait here," replied Moses. "I will hear what orders God gives regarding your case."
Right.
Oh, that's fascinating. So now
let's just understand this. The Paschal lamb has to be offered basically when a person is ritually pure, and coming in contact with the dead is one of the ways of not being pure. It's a mitzvah to bury the dead.
Because
being impure is not bad. Being impure is a certain state. And when one is in that state, there are certain things you can't do. And so one of the things you can't do is go into the temple ground.
It's unclean rather than impure. Mm.
Well, it's a spiritual
issue. It's a spiritual issue.
It's a ritual. It's something.
They can go to a bath and bath it all off. That's not the issue.
But it's not the physical thing.
But translation, he was always ritually unclean.
Well, because it's the ritual, it's a spiritual quality. It's not a matter of what, as Mindy said, it's not a matter of washing it in soap. In order to become spiritually pure, like going to a mikveh, one first has to be perfectly clean.
But you gave an example once that if a man was unclean and he forgot, or he didn't realize he was unclean, by making love to his wife, he was spiritually cleansed.
Yes.
Is that true?
That's a very interesting story about Rabbi Joseph Caro.
But is it real, or this is just
Rabbi happened? Joseph Caro was
a
very...
Work in this?
he was the great rabbi who wrote the Code of Law. And he lived in the 16th century.
Yes, I remember
Svart.
Now. Yes.
And he was a very eminent figure. However, he also had a mystical practice that in the middle of the night he would get up and recite Mishnah by heart. And while he was reciting Mishnah by heart, then suddenly a voice would come from within him saying, Ani ha-Mishnah medaberet mitoch picha. I am the Mishnah speaking through your mouth. And it would tell him things, and he would write them down. And that diary has been preserved, and it's published. You can buy it in a bookshop here in London. It's called Magid Meir Sharim. You can certainly find it on the web.
Wow, this is amazing, yes.
And so in this diary, we find all kinds of interesting points made by this mystical spiritual communication.
And one of them is?
So one of them is that he had become impure that day. And he then made love with his wife. And making love to his wife acted as a purifying force, which purified him. So which is a very interesting concept, that making love brings purity to the person.
Well, it's spiritual.
Yeah, very spiritual.
It's the ultimate of spirituality.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but getting back to the point, how does one cleanse?
Well, read on.
Well, wait a second. We're going to see how the problem's resolved.
Right.
But how does one cleanse? Normally, one gets clean from most kinds of impurity
water.
By going to the mikveh.
Yes.
Immersing without any, naked, without any interposition in the mikveh. And in the case of purity from death, impurity from being near a corpse, there's an additional factor that you need the ashes of a red heifer. And the ashes,
which we don't have,
which we don't have at this moment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the ashes have to be sprinkled on you one day and then a few days later.
I think it's 7 days, isn't it?
Yeah, it takes 7 days.
My father's impure constantly. He works. In
the Chevra Kedisha. How amazing.
Since he's 60.
Wow.
82 now.
Well, that's a very special role in the Jewish community. And it's interesting that even though it's the most holy role, it still makes you impure from the dead. But we regard all of us as being impure from the dead. You go for a walk on Hampstead Heath, who knows who is buried underground? You just walked over the grave of a Viking.
Yeah, I know, yes.
Now,
in South Africa, one of the Afrikaans politicians once in Parliament accused that the Jews in South Africa had subversive activities, and one of the Jews, he said, yeah, he says, it's an underground movement, we call it the Chevra Kedisha.
I love it!
He understood it. Well, he proved his case.
That was the debate in Parliament.
Try that on Jeremy Corbyn.
You never know.
The question is, who laughed?
The same Jewish politician complimented the Afrikaans politicians, on getting their education in the higher branches.
You were shocking.
All right. Now, so these people have come with a complaint. They were not able to join in. Everyone was having this beautiful festival and they couldn't join in because they were impure.
Couldn't eat the beautiful supper.
And they missed out on the beautiful night. Michael,
never mind the impurity, I used to love it.
Poor Michael had no ideas.
All right, so let's hear the next bit.
There we go.
Making up the Passover offering. God spoke to Moses.
God spoke to Moses, telling him to speak to the Israelites, saying, if any person is ritually unclean from contact with the dead, or is on a distant journey, whether among you now or in future generations, he shall still have the opportunity to prepare God's Passover offering.
It's actually 408.
Yeah, but he shall prepare. He shall prepare it on the afternoon of the 14th of the second month, and shall eat it with matzahs and bitter herbs. He shall not leave any of it over until morning, and not break any bone in it. He shall thus prepare it according to all the rules of the regular Passover offering.
Right, so now let's just understand this. The 14th of the second month, whereas the real Passover offering, or the original Passover offering, is the 14th of the first month.
Ah.
Nisan is the first month.
That's right.
And Iyar is the second month.
Month. Yeah.
So this is what is called Pesach Sheni, the second Pesach.
Ah, yes.
And it's saying that if they didn't manage, if someone didn't manage to offer to take part in the Pesach offering in the first month, the 14th of Nisan, and he wasn't able to get to the temple for some reason, and so he wasn't able to, he might have been impure, or as it says here, he was on a journey, he was away, and so he couldn't do it, he didn't do it. Now, however, when it's the second month, then he's got another chance to bring the Pesach offering.
Yeah.
Now, this is a very remarkable thing, because there are many festivals in Judaism, and this is the only case of a festival where you have the ability to make it up if you missed it. You know, if someone, if it was Rosh Hashanah and you didn't hear the shofar, you know, this happened, that happened, you were supposed to get back to London or wherever the day before, but the plane was diverted and you ended up in, Iceland.
Timbuktu.
And there was no Chabad house. So I'm not sure if there's a Chabad house in Iceland, but I'm not sure if there's one in Timbuktu. So, with time.
Oh, that reminds me, I'm sorry, diverting. This horrible story in Sweden about this family that had to pay.
Yeah, that's my children.
You are joking. Because Shaul was asking me, do you know the story? Did you hear about it?
No.
Well, maybe Tali should tell it. I'm sure
it must be much discussed. I mean, there are various things as we go through all this. I mean, if you look at it, without the benefit, so to speak, of a whole hinterland of commentary. I mean, there are several points that came up in this. I don't know. The menorah, each flame, you were saying, symbolizes a different type of love or a different type of spiritual quality. But I mean, it's a strange thing, because why would the flames be any different one from the other? I mean, it's a purely conjectural or academic distinction. I mean, you would say perhaps, if you were going to emphasize the diversity, that the fact that there are seven different arms shows a sort of individuality or an individuating idea, but not the flame itself, because that's pretty well uniform.
That's such a beautiful point. That's such a beautiful point. Because there is a discussion among the Kabbalists. You see, the Sfirot, the divine emanations, are seen as a radiance within a vessel.
Within a?
Within a vessel.
A vessel.
Vessel. Mm-hmm. Or ukli, radiance and vessel. Now, I don't know if you remember, but you might, the Rupert stories of many, many years ago. It was a kind of a comic book,
mm-hmm.
with Rupert, Yes. Yeah. And he, at some point, there are these like jars of light in these stories. And they somehow figure. And when I began to learn about Spirot, I thought back to these jars of light in the Rupert Bear stories. So there's a jar of light, there's a vessel of radiance. And there's a discussion among the Kabbalists whether the difference between the different Spirot is only in the vessel, but the light is the same in each vessel. So if you shine a light in a vessel of blue glass, it's going to look different to the same light in a vessel of red glass or yellow glass. Mm-hmm. Or is the light itself different in some way? So what you're saying relates to that. You know, was there some way, you can understand that this branch of the menorah is on this side and the other one is next to it, it's a different position. Now, is there any, and this one is love, this kind of love, that kind of love. Is the flame in any real way different, or could it be that looking at the flame we would see some sort of distinction? These are beautiful ideas.
Well, I mean, that would depend on the positioning of the menorah at the time of day, so that, you know, an arm that's further removed from the centre or whichever side would be slightly...
Well, listen, it's quite clear that the temple and all its appurtenances was pregnant with meaning. You know, it was redolent with meaning. And it was a very, very spiritual domain. And coming into that domain, visiting the temple, was a spiritual experience.
To what you said, to what you both said, maybe there is, maybe it's the combination of, as long as we're having the discussion, that in itself is the answer.
Mm. So, that's very beautiful.
Yeah?
Yeah.
The question
and the discussion are part of the reality of this.
It's a conjectural idea rather than based in...
It's important we are discussing it. Without this discussion, it doesn't mean anything. But on another aspect, I was taught that I'm the vessel.
Mm.
Me. Without me, there is nothing. Mm. So I'm the vessel.
All is temple of the self.
Yes. We are each the vessel.
And each one of us is a crucial element. One of the images about this, it's a different image.
Yeah.
It's a Torah scroll.
Yes.
And each individual is like a letter in the Torah scroll. And you know that if a Torah scroll has one letter scratched out, or a little scratch in the letter,
not kosher.
You can't use the entire Torah scroll.
But the slight problem with that is you're founding your rationale on the different types of light, not on the basis that it's proclaimed to be, that the light in itself is different, but on the basis that we are individually vessels ourselves, and therefore our thinking about them is actually what. So it's a different basis, which is a justifiable basis. But I mean,
sorry, you were going to say
the light a metaphor for a moral force, because I think it is a famous Italian writer, the Italo Calvino, who said he didn't believe in the right to life; you have to earn it. What he means is. And I think it's a very Jewish idea, I mean, it was Italian. We all occupy a certain physical space, and that we have a responsibility to behave in a certain way, which is the Jewish idea of the covenant and so on. You know, it's not there's no blood and soil relationship with the land of Israel. You live there according to certain codes of behavior. And that the image of the light is the moral force which exists within everybody.
That's a very beautiful image.
I think that's perfect.
That's a very beautiful image.
Yeah.
But when I said that, I bought one of his books in the Oxfam shop. So I said this to the cashier, she didn't have a clue what I was talking about. But I said, he said that you don't have a right, this idea of a human right.
Yeah, and what's
right,
his name?
The Human Rights Act talks about the right to life. Mm. There is no right
Calvini. Is it Calvini?
Calvini.
Yeah, Calvino. Italo Calvino. Calvino.
I'd like
what's
to
the
read
first name? First name?
Italo.
Italo. Calvino. Italo Calvino.
Yes, he's all, he writes. He's very. He's a sort of Kafka type.
Fascinating.
Right. But I think that's a very profound idea.
Yes.
Because if you have a right, after all, a right is only a right, and it can be taken away.
Well, you see, that fits very much with, for example, because people were betraying their relationship with God, that's right. Why God sent the flood. And after the flood, we have, you know, clearly the concept of the seven Noahide laws governing human life, that human life should be keeping the covenant with God, giving them life on the basis of them keeping the seven Noahide laws. That's so that makes a lot of very profound sense. But you see, within Torah images, whether it's the image of the menorah, of the Jews in Egypt, the Jews coming out of Egypt, all of these events have got different levels of interpretation, and including a way of interpreting it as something to do with each individual. Like Alan saying, I am the vessel. That's what I was taught. You know, so there's a sense in which you are Moses. You, the sanctuary is inside you. That you are the one who comes out of Egypt. You are the one who gets the Torah. You're the one who wanders in the desert. You're the one who enters the promised land. It's all focused in you. And the Kabbalistic explanations with radiance and spherot and worlds and names, divine names, it's all the way in which this interface can be expressed, that the past and the present and the future intermingle, and the Jewish people coming out of Egypt and having the sanctuary and making this paschal lamb and then not being able to make it because they were impure, and then the solution to the problem. Now let's get on to the solution for a moment. The solution was a very remarkable solution. A month later, do the same festival, right? A month later, that's given you time. It takes a week to get away from impurity of the dead. So now you'll be pure, ritually pure, and then you make the festival. So the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, his name was Rabbi Joseph Isaac. He passed away in 1950, very profound thinker. He said, from this incident in the Torah, we learn that in all aspects of human life, it's never too late. Kaimel nishfa fal. That you don't say, oh, that's the end, I've lost it. No, you can get it back, you can repair it, you can build it, you can create it, you can have it back again. And we learned that from this incident where they missed the festival, and then God says in this extraordinary way, you can have the festival back, yes, a month later. And so from that about everything in life, never say die. You can always jump up again.
We're never too old. It's not quite Shakespearean, is it? There's a time and a... I've actually wondered about that Shakespearean thing. There's a time and a tide in the affairs of man which taken in its flood leave... You know the phrase. I mean, but the very fact, the image of a tide itself is something that comes in and out. So I thought there's a...
Well, it comes in...
Well, so I was trying to... Sorry to get back to Brexit.
The place will be emptied.
Yeah, you all walk out.
You'll be
good idea. But you're allowing in the idea that you're founding the interpretation on the justification on individual interpretation. We think this, therefore, it sort of, so to speak, is.
That's the
objective. Sort of looking at it. I mean, there are all sorts of ideas here that probably deserve. I mean, there must have been. I can't be the first one to have thought of them. I mean, here were two. I mean, we were talking about the dragon being the symbol of Rome, of paganism, if you will. But I mean, how come male goats are offered for sin? I mean, that goes back to another very ancient myth that predates Judaism, I suspect. You know, the goat, and probably it's a sort of sexual misdemeanor in a way. Why is the goat the or goat, the male goat particularly, singled out as being the offering for sin.
Well, there are several different offerings which can be offered for sin or for other things. And one of the ways of understanding the whole idea of offerings in the temple is that inside each of us, there's an animal soul. Now, the animal souls have different qualities. One person has a gentle animal soul like a lamb. Another has an animal soul like a goring ox. Another one like a goat. And when we offer the sacrifice in the temple, what we are trying to do is spiritualize our own animal aspect and elevate it so that its innate spirituality can be revealed. Because really, this animal part of us is positive. It's only a cloak which makes it problematic.
Otherwise we wouldn't reproduce.
Yes. Well,
we wouldn't we wouldn't want
Well, there's the concept of the union between man and woman, as Alan said before, we were talking before the case of Rabbi Joseph Karam. That union is something sacred, something very, very holy on the highest level. At the same time, when we look at society, it can be the same kind of desire in a perverted way or in a crude way, in a reductionist way. It's one of the biggest problems that there are, the incidents of rape, of abuse, and other things like that. And so you have the highest and the lowest, and we have to be able to understand that really something can be very, very exalted, but it can be cloaked in a negative form, and it can therefore act in a negative way. Okay, let's go a little bit further. If we turn the next page to page 408, on that day the tabernacle was erected. So Michael, would you like to read? Here, it's page 408. And it's
on the day that the tabernacle was erected, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of testimony. Then in the evening there was something that appeared to be like fire on the tabernacle, remaining there until morning. From then on it remained that way. There was a cloud covering it by day and a fire-like apparition by night. Whenever the cloud rose up from the tent, the Israelites would set out on the march. The Israelites would then camp in the place where the cloud rested. The Israelites would thus move on at God's bidding, and at God's bidding they would remain in one place for as long as the cloud remained on the tabernacle. If the cloud remained over the tabernacle for a long time, the Israelites would keep their trust in God and not travel on. In some cases, the cloud would remain on the tabernacle for just a few days, and they would similarly remain camped at God's word and then move on at God's word.
Thank you. Millie, would you like to go on? There are even cases.
There are even cases where the clouds remained only from evening to morning. When the cloud then rose in the morning, they would travel on.
At other time,
it might be for a day and night, and they would then move on when the cloud rose. Thus, whether it was for 2 days, a month, or a full year, no matter how long the clouds remained at rest ever the tabernacle, the Israelite would remain in one place and not move on. Then, when the cloud rose, they would continue on their travels. They thus camped at God's word and moved on God's word, keeping, this is not very clear,
Their trust
in God. It's mushed up. Somebody else should take
it. It was all done according to God's word.
Yeah, after that. So.
Yeah, it was all done according to God's word through Moses. Now, to me,
is this a translation from
the Hebrew?
From the Hebrew.
Yeah. Now, to me, this is a very, very intimate expression of traveling through the desert of life with the sanctuary, with the holiness of the divine, and in a way, God moving us this way, that way, stopping for a day or a month or a year, and then moving on. And
yeah, it makes sense, actually. It's lovely analogy.
I saw differently, actually. I saw the light being the more important issue. The fact that we took the menorah maybe from...
Well, this is very... Well, I mean, what's being emphasized in the text is that for them, the divine guidance was obvious. There was a pillar of cloud during the day and a pillar of fire at night, and it was obvious that God's presence was there looking after them and guiding them.
And so the time wasn't, to me, the important, it was that.
Right. So for me, I extrapolate from this that in fact each of us is being guided by God, we just don't realize it. That's we don't see it clearly. But that sense of Gam ki elech, even though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, I will not fear evil because you are with me.
Yes.
So that kind of sense of the proximity, the closeness of the divine, wherever one is. And that's the ultimate freedom. And there were people in Auschwitz who felt that freedom.
I was going to use that. I was still thinking to myself, every time I walk in a dangerous place, I think, you know, he says he's going to protect me, but I think I still need a cricket bat.
Well, Well, what's the English saying? Trust in God, but keep the powder dry.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Because what Jewish teaching says is that you have to do things in the real world.
Yes.
It's and if it's a dangerous place, then take steps to do something about it. Set up schools to educate people so that they won't be dangerous hoodlums. Yeah. Introduce a spiritual dimension in the education you give. All right.
About jobs.
Yeah. All right. So these are three little but I think are quite deep
beautiful
messages from the Seder this week. The menorah, the sense of the unity of the Jewish people, and the interactive
quality. Sorry, you said seven spheres.
Spheres.
As Millie was saying, of the ten.
Now, the ten start with the intellectual, wisdom, understanding, and knowledge.
Yes.
And then there is love, or mercy.
So you separate the first three.
Yes, victory, submission, dedication, kingship. So there's the first three, which are intellectual, and then the lower seven, which are emotional. Yeah.
And we are at the bottom, Malchut, yes?
Well, Malchut is like fulfillment and the creative power, right? And which is also the feminine.
Oh, is it? Of course, yes.
Yeah.
The
intellectual is wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. Wisdom represents inspiration, like a spark of inspiration. Understanding is taking that spark and broadening it and seeing different aspects, like a river flowing from a point where the stream, the spring emerges from the mountain. That's like wisdom. And then it becomes a river, which is like understanding. And then it flows down into the valley. This is like da'at, knowledge, like man knew, Adam knew Eve. It means being committed, getting something done, being determined.
Tali's got a beautiful drawing of this that maybe he will bring for you.
Mm-hmm.
Which will explain this. Beautiful.
So those are the three intellectual ones. And then there are the emotional ones, which is chesed, kindness, love, giving, wanting to give. But then you might feel that you're trying to give too much, so that has to be severity, holding it back.
That's why you've got the left and the right.
That's right.
Isn't it?
So yes. The right is the giving and the left is holding back. And then there's a medium point in the middle, which is mercy, where you're giving the right way, in the appropriate way, called mercy. And then there is netzach, being victorious, winning, enduring, going through all kinds of opposition. And then there's submission, on the other hand. And then there's dedication, love, in a dedicated way. And then that flows into malchut, kingship, the feminine, which is realizing something, like when an artist is thinking about what he's going to paint, and finally he gets down and paints it, that's malchut, that's kingship, that's the expression. So that whole image of the Sfirot, of the divine emanations, is there in the menorah at the beginning of the Seder, which also represents the unity of the Jewish people and the interactive relationship we all have with each other. And ultimately this radiance illuminates everywhere, illuminates the world. And we then have the idea of it never being too late, as relating to the Pesach Sheni. Many people have the custom on that day of the 14th of Iyar, a month after Pesach, they eat some matzah as well. And then we had this third little passage of walking through the desert, which is really, in my interpretation, the desert of time. It's okay.
And next week we'll do the trumpets.